You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another podcast episode. So today I am sitting in the studio with Zach Van Proyen to talk about house hacking here in Denver. So Zach actually started house hacking in 2010, before I think the term house hacking was even used, but the concept was around. So back in 2010, he bought a duplex. And then last year, he bought house hack number 2 in Aurora. So I asked Zach to come in here to talk about his experience in house hacking and just share his knowledge, since so many investors want to go down the house hacking route. So Zach, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris. Excited to be here.
So just kind of jumping into it, let's start off and talking about 2010, you bought this duplex in Denver, right?
Correct. East Denver. Yeah.
So in East Denver. So what made you think, like, how come you're thinking about, oh, I want to buy a place and rent out one side? Like, how did you even get that thought process going?
So I've always kind of been a personal finance nerd and came across financial independence and just looking for different ways to achieve that. So started looking at different scenarios, investing in index funds, dividend stocks, and real estate just really made a lot of sense at the time when I'd run the numbers. And house hacking, yeah, like you said, I didn't know the term existed. Maybe it did, but I didn't know about it.
I think it's more of a recent term that I think actually Bigger Pockets coined that term, but
yeah, definitely. So, way back, you know, I've always been into real estate, read a ton of books, and I had a conversation with a family friend, and he was telling me about how he got started in real estate. He had a decent portfolio, and, you know, I just asked him, how'd you get started? And he told me his parents were real estate investors when he went to college. They told him, hey, the best thing to do is we'll help you get into a house, 4 or 5 bedrooms. You can rent it out to your friends, to your classmates, you know, and cover the mortgage. And by the time he finished college, he had an income producing asset, substantial equity, and he kind of got the crash course in property management. And it really resonated with me and just, you know, that's something I want to do. And I had read a book, Investing in Duplexes, Triplexes, Quads, I think Larry Loftus, and he kind of had a similar strategy where you'd buy a quad, so fourplex, rent 3 units out and live in one, get some equity, save some cash, and then do it again if you repeat every 2 years. You know, 10 years from now or 5 years from now, you'd have a couple properties. And so, you know, that's what I want to do. So started looking on realtor.com, Craigslist, and properties, multifamilies under 250 at the time. There was a ton of inventory. And I know that price sounds crazy today.
And that's 250 for the whole duplex, not 250 per side.
For a quad even, yeah.
Oh, yeah, even for quad back then.
And I noticed there's an agent. He didn't have the listings, but he kind of pulled some listings off the MLS, and he'd put the pictures up and a little pro forma at the bottom. And I was like, wow, this guy kind of, he's thinking the same lines I am. So I reached out to him and got on the list and put together a little spreadsheet. And every morning I'd get the list of properties, plug in the numbers, see what would work, and then go view the properties. And quickly I'd find that the properties that looked the best on paper, it wouldn't really work for me. And a lot of that had to do with they needed a ton of work. And at the time, I didn't have a lot of cash saved down. I didn't have any contractors or any contacts. So I knew that I was trying to stay away from the major rehabs or really any rehab at the time. So must have looked at 100 properties. You know, he really earned his commission check on that. But
really?
Yeah, it was a ton because there was a ton of inventory at the time.
And then let's pause here and talk about that because then we're talking, I mean, the markets are, we're talking two different extremes right now, or right now we're extreme sellers. Back then was extreme buyer's market. And so you look like 100 some multifamilies.
Yeah. And that was over 4 or 5 months. We were looking at a lot.
I don't even think in 4 or 5 months, 100 multifamilies come on the MLS anymore.
Yeah. I think when we looked last year, there might've been like 6 or 7 active that were kind of in my price range. Yeah. Just amazing. So it was
what were the numbers? You said you put together a spreadsheet. And obviously, you were going in there with living one side, we're not the other side. Or were you totally selling duplexes? Or were you looking at duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes as well?
Yeah, starting out, the numbers just looked great on the fourplexes.
Yeah.
But as I started looking at them, either they needed a ton of work that I didn't have the money for, or the contacts, or they were one bedroom, one bath, weird layouts, places that I wouldn't want to live personally. Yeah. And I was a young guy in my 20s, I had pretty low standards. So if I didn't want to live there, it'd probably be difficult to attract quality renters. So yeah, ultimately I decided on a duplex that had been remodeled, as turnkey as you can get. It was built in 1909. But they bought it foreclosed, a fix and flipper, for $99,000. Redid everything, the furnace, water heater, electrical, plumbing, floors, you know, the whole bit to sell at retail. So it was basically turnkey. The numbers weren't as great, but it was about $1,000 worth of market rents for each side. One side was a 2-bedroom, 1-bath. The other side was a 3-bedroom, so side-by-side duplex.
Okay.
Kind of a middle common area. So
what's in the common area? Just like washer, dryer, like laundry?
Exactly,
room?
Washer, dryer, hookup.
Okay.
So that was one of the sacrifices you had to make, you had to share a washer and dryer with the tenant. So yeah, we got into that, or I got into that.
And what did you buy it for?
So about $180,000. Did 5% down, conventional.
Yeah.
And mortgage was about $1,000 at the time.
Yeah. And so what were the numbers you were on? Because you said you put together a spreadsheet. And Zach and I, just to give everyone context, we've talked, we've had quite a few conversations about finance stuff and numbers. So, you know, Zach knows his numbers and runs things. So I'm kind of curious to know how you were running your numbers back then. Like, were you just looking for a certain amount over mortgage payments, or what were you calculating?
Yeah, exactly. So one of the advantages of the house hack is you get rid of your biggest expense, your housing expense. So at the time, kind of at a minimum, I wanted to at least have a very small mortgage payment. But running the numbers, like you said, on the on some of the fourplexes, you might come out $800 or $1,000 a month ahead, which is unbelievable. So yeah, I would put together all the market rents, and usually I put myself in the shoes of the renters. You know, if I wanted to rent a similar property, you know, go on Craigslist or Zillow and kind of look what's in the market and just kind of get a conservative idea of the rents. So put together all the rents. I was going to do the self-managing, so no property management.
Yep.
But Joe Massey actually has an excellent spreadsheet that I use now, but I had something basic like that where you'd plug in, you know, vacancies, repairs, maintenance, what my principal interest, all that is.
Do you remember what the numbers you were plugging in back then were?
Oh, back, well, I think I was getting them out of a book, so probably okay. Like 12% for vacancy, even though, actually at the time, vacancy, that was probably a pretty good number for vacancy. And then a lot of times you'll hear this 50% rule for expenses, like bigger pockets, you'll see it all the time. And I think that really varies by market. So a couple things to keep in mind, that 50% number is going to include property taxes, and insurance, which are included in the mortgage payment on the calculation. And then, I mean, historically, like right now I'm renting my first duplex for $3,100 a month total. Now that I'm moved out, you know, this is down the road. And to think $1,500 a month or $18,000 a year is quite a bit in expenses. So I think on Joe Massey's spreadsheet, they use 5% for repairs and maintenance. I kind of bumped that up to 10% just to be a little bit more conservative.
Yeah.
Which is historically in line, kind of what I've been seeing.
Is that what you've seen in terms of expenses with your duplexes, right around about 10% total and
for repairs and maintenance?
Repairs, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'm very familiar with the 50% rule. Now a lot of our listeners are as well. And just to clarify, I agree with you, Zach, because, you know, 50% of rents in Denver, which are much higher, 50% is, you know, a lot more money than 50% in Oklahoma Detroit. Or Detroit, where, you know, rents are lower, but a lot of times you're, you know, a new roof there, a new roof here, you know, not too far off. A water heater there, a water heater there. I mean, talking about those different markets, like costs are very similar. So yeah, it's very hard to use that 50% rule in, I'll say, markets like Denver or place with higher price rent. So we generally use like, yeah, 5 to 10%.
Exactly. So
yeah. And so yeah, I'm really curious about this. So you bought this in 2010. We're recording this in Q1 of 2019. So it's averaged out to about 10% per year of rents for your repairs, maintenance, and those types of expenses?
It's actually been less than that.
Okay.
But I know some of the, like I bought it, everything was remodeled and
Yeah. Pretty
new. So I know their life expectancy on these things. So it's not always going to remain this low. So.
What how low has it been roughly? Do you know? Do you know that? I know it's a hard number to pull.
Geez, yeah.
Especially since you lived there for years. So you probably did a lot of work yourself for cheap or free.
A lot of little things come up with handyman. But yeah, surprisingly, there really have not been a lot of expenses associated with a few things like a fuse on an oven went out. So that was like $50 to have a tech come over, replace the fuse. Just a lot of little things over time. But yeah, I would probably less than 5%, to be honest.
Okay.
But yeah, we've been very fortunate.
Nice. So going back there to when you bought it 2010, so you got it for, you said, for 180. 180. and you did a 5% down conventional, because now you can't do 5% down conventional on duplexes, but that's cool. And so what were your numbers like back then? So you're renting out one side for $1,000, you said, and were you renting out the two-bedroom or three-bedroom side?
The two-bedroom, one-bath, so okay. The smaller side. And then I lived in the larger side.
Okay. Did you have roommates in the larger side, or did you just...
The original plan was to have a roommate come in, and then my fiance is my wife now. She decided to move in like a month after, so a little bit of a surprise. So I didn't have the roommate situation, but...
How much did you charge her in rent?
I didn't charge her.
Probably a bad joke. Okay, so renting out one side for $1,000, 5% down on, what's that, $165,000 loan? What was your monthly payment?
Roughly about $1,000 a month, $1,069, I think.
And that's for principal, interest, taxes, and insurance.
And there was PMI at the time, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So now I'm sure your PMI has dropped off because that duplex has appreciated a couple bucks at least.
Exactly.
Cool. So talk about what you were doing while you're living there. How hard was it to find a tenant? Especially in those marketing conditions back then, what was it like?
Yeah, so back then I didn't have a ton of experience. You know, I'm brand new to it. So Put the ads up on Craigslist. You know, I read a couple books and about tenant screening. And I had a few people look at it, nothing too serious. I probably was a little bit too stringent. I'm an underwriter in my 9-to-5 job. So this is probably a little too stringent looking at some of the credit. But I actually ended up getting a case manager from the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. And they put my first tenant in. I think the rent was $995. The coalition paid $975. The tenant was responsible for $20. And amazingly enough, she was late on the $20 every month. But she was an awesome tenant.
Was this Section 8 or was this a different program?
Yeah, it's a different program. So okay. They call it the Coalition for the Homeless. So.
Okay.
So she stayed there for about the first year. I actually let her out a month early on the lease, but... So posted again and, you know, a ton of response. Since I've been doing this, even back in 2011, there's a lot of demand from the Section 8 tenants looking for a place to live. And I wasn't familiar with Section 8 at all. So I kept getting requests. I did a little bit of research, kind of went through the normal tenant screening. So, I've gotten a lot more advanced now in the last vacancy.
When you say normal, you're talking about looking at like credit score and income to rent ratio. Like what was your basic criteria back then?
Yeah. So back then it was 3 times the rent mm-hmm. for income, which a lot of times you have to factor in the voucher for Section 8. So that makes it a little tricky. So let's say they have a voucher for $1,200 a month. So their housing expense is covered. They do, if they don't make enough, I think they do some type of calculation. You know, don't quote me on it, but maybe like 30% of the gross or the net income they have to pay out of pocket.
That sounds right around the ballpark, yeah.
So, yeah, I would go through that, the standard application. I think I was using TransUnion Smart Move back then, where they'd fill out the application online, put all the information in, get back a credit report. Kind of looks similar to what you'd see on Credit Karma or your credit card company. I'm just looking for not a specific FICO score, but on the credit report, no evictions, mm-hmm. Bankruptcies, maybe if they're aged and you see some strong reestablishment, judgments or major current derog. And I would let them know up front on the phone screen, you know, because it did cost $35 to apply. So just make sure, you know, that wasn't going to be an issue before they applied. And got lucky. A older woman with a couple of adopted grandsons moved in and they had been at the other place long term. He was selling the house, so they had to move. She let me know they want to stay forever. Great references, income checked out. Credit was actually really good for a Section 8 tenant. And I got lucky with that. Still tenant to this day, just family.
Nice. Okay. And then we've talked about just as we started working together and getting to know each other last year, 2 years ago at this point. Because I know you bought that in 2010 with the plan on buying another property. I think, sometime in their future after a couple years is what you said. But you ended up staying on the sideline for a while because the market was increasing so much. Kind of share what was going on because that's right. You bought at a great time and then the market started picking up soon after that. What were your plans and then how were you reacting to the market? Like, what was your thought process?
Exactly. So yeah, that was the plan going in 2010. You know, every year or 2 years, I was going to buy one of these multifamilies, the house hacking method. And 2 years go by and I start looking at similar properties to mine and the prices had doubled. It was just crazy. $400,000 for the same type of house that I was in now. And
they doubled from 2010 to 2012.
Yeah. Okay. For a similar house. Yeah. Yeah. So I just thought, wow, this is crazy. Inventory had shrunk. There's tons of competition, multiple offers on everything. And I thought, maybe I'm just going to let this cool down a little bit. And so a year passes, look, and even less inventory, prices had risen even more. A couple more years go by and I'm like, man, so I just really had a moment of reflection. And I started thinking, why don't I approach this the same way that I'm approaching my retirement accounts, which is dollar cost averaging, not trying to time the market.
Yeah.
Because there is an opportunity cost associated with sitting on the sidelines. If you're waiting for a 20% dip in the market or, whatever it may be, you're missing out on that appreciation. So I kind of thought about ways to manage that risk or mitigate that risk. And
mitigate the opportunity cost risk?
No, actually. So the other way. So the risk of buying in maybe the top of the market. So,
okay.
You start hearing the bubble talk and everything's going to crash and you don't want to buy at the top of this market. I was really fortunate at the timing. 2010 was, just about the best time to buy. So in the back of my head, I'm thinking those are the numbers. That's what I should be looking for. And they don't exist. They may never exist in Denver again.
So how are you mitigating that risk? I'm curious, because you're like, okay, hey, we may be at the top of the market. Who knows what happens? How are you going to mitigate that risk?
So the first thing I thought about is, worst case scenario, I buy a place for $400,000, the market crashes by 20%. But does that really affect me if I'm not selling the property? I'm not going to lose that money unless I sell. The other thing is maybe rents fall, there's a recession, people lose their jobs. So those are kind of the main risks that I'm trying to balance. So the first plan is cash reserves, just in case I didn't have a tenant and all my units were vacant, I wanted to have 6 months of mortgage payment.
Per property.
Yep. So yeah, six months for every mortgage I have on the, on my credit. And then the second is 6 months of living expenses. So if I were to lose my job or, anything major came up, I'd have 6 months of my own living expenses. And then after that, I would save up for a down payment and, just proceed there. So as soon as I had enough money saved up for a down payment, I'd look for the next property.
Okay. And so when did you start having that thought process for kind of hedging, I'll say protecting yourself and being prepared by? Was that a year ago, a couple years ago?
Yeah, probably around 2016, I think. And then okay. I found you and Charles, reached out, and I think we had a cup of coffee and you guys had very similar views to me in investing and just decided let's take the dive and jump in and get another one.
And I want to circle back around to I'm always curious about just some personal finance. So, because I'm similar with, holding high cash reserves, where do you park your cash? Because I always have the internal debate. Like, I like having cash because sleep well at night, can handle issues, but, generally you're losing out to inflation a little bit. So you're a finance guy. Where do you put your cash reserves?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had the debate all the time.
And, yeah.
I err on the side of caution. So I use an online savings account. Cap One is 2% on balances over 10,000.
Yeah.
Liquid, FDIC insured. You think about, there's tons of different options. I've seen some people get aggressive and put in an index fund, but I just want that available liquid cash. So
no, I'm the exact same way. I don't use Capital One. I use Ally Bank, which is pretty much the same thing. And they're paying like 2% or 2.1 right now. But I've talked to a lot of investors where they park their cash in an index fund, which is great when the market's been a bull market. But this last year, the stock market has definitely had some volatility. And I've had people say, now I want to wait because I don't want to pull out my money while I'm losing a few bucks. I'm like, yeah, well, that's the risk you're taking and who knows what's going to happen. So I'm like you, because that money, in 30 years, it might be worth a few bucks less. But man, you can handle any curveball that comes up
exactly.
With those types of cash reserves.
And I'm looking to deploy in the next couple of years. So I'm not looking for the 7 or 8% that historically it's at. But like you mentioned last year, you lose 6% and kind of put you backwards a little bit.
Great. So going back to, I think we started looking in 2017, if I'm remembering correctly, or maybe I can't, something like that, a couple of years ago. So as you were looking, what was going on with your duplex? Because obviously you bought for 185 and it was worth way more than 185. What had rents done? Kind of like, what was your current place looking like then?
Yes. So I was with Section 8. So every, you can request a rent increase. And I noticed I was below market. And that was one of my mistakes I made earlier, is I wasn't asking for that rent increase every year, which I could have been. So started bumping that up 100 a year. So I got to like $1,295 at the time. And yeah, the prices were crazy. I actually have a home equity line of credit, and they were running a promotion where you could lock in like a 4.24 for 2 years. I knew rates were going up, so I figured I'd do that. So I went to increase the home equity line of credit on that duplex, and the appraisal came in something crazy, like $585,000. And I'm like, wow, I would not pay that for this property, but it was just crazy where things have gone.
Yeah. Great. So then we were, so when you start looking for house hack number two, you're renting on one side for $1,295, living in the other. And then what was, I mean, you, that was not, now buying a second house hack where Charles and I helped you, was not your first rodeo. So you've had experience, you got a lot more savvy underneath you. Like, how'd you approach round two versus round one of buying? Like, what had changed for you?
Well, first I, you know, tempered my expectations because I knew from sitting on the sidelines that I'm not going to get the same type of numbers that I was looking at before. But yeah, I think we had alluded to earlier is that there weren't a ton of multifamilies on the market, and I was going to have to put a little bit more cash down to get into something like that. So we started looking at alternatives.
Let me pause you right here because I get asked multiple times a week about multi-units in Denver for house hacking. So since you own one and you've seen the market shift around multi-units for these, I mean, the prices just skyrocketed so quickly, you know, right after you bought it. Just describe what you saw, the numbers, and why you didn't decide to pursue one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, there are probably five active multifamilies on that. And
I mean, that was like, $500,000, I think. It was
exactly, like $565 for a two-bedroom, and yeah, the rents you might be able to get $1,400 for, and just really didn't make a ton of sense at the time, at least not with the house hacking in the down payment that we had.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we started looking at single-family homes with mother-in-law basements, separate entrances, kind of a clear division where we could live in the basement and then rent the top or the main house out.
And what would you find if you started looking at those places? Like, how did what were the numbers like? How did they compare to duplex? You know, just pros and cons.
Yeah, so definitely the numbers look better. We're able to put 5% down, conventional. And yeah, the prices, you probably find some in the 300 range, 350 range. And one of our criteria was kind of, we wanted to be 10 minutes from downtown where Martha worked at the time. So we started looking in Southwest Denver, and we might've been a couple years late because it was very popular. Every house that would work at, you know, there were multiple offers the first day that it came on the market.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the houses that would clear separate entrance. I think there were other house hackers or, you know, our multi-generational families. So a lot of competition in Southwest Denver. We actually had one under contract where I think there were 26 other offers on the property.
Oh, yes.
And it would have worked great. It was a nice neighborhood. We liked it. But yeah, they were like 26. So we ended up going over, asking, you know, contingencies. We'd have the cash to bring to the table if the appraisal didn't come back. Already pretty thin. The numbers would work, though. You know, the way we're looking at it is I run the numbers, live in there, and then after we move out, and looking for a little bit of cushion. So
are you more concerned with the numbers while you live in there, or is it more just once you move out, that's the more important numbers?
Moving out is kind of what we're looking at. I like to have some cushion in the numbers. So, you know, after I put everything in the spreadsheet and put 10% for repairs and 5% for vacancy, kind of do like a stress test to the, you know, if rents were to drop 10%, if they were to drop 20%, what's this going to look like? You know, and at the bare minimum, I want to break even if rents were to fall 20%. And so
what type of cushion, what was the type of spread or cushion you're looking for?
Roughly $400 or $500 a month.
Yeah.
You know, after post moving out. So
let me ask you this, because this always brings up an interesting topic to me, because, you know, the low down payment for house hacking, you know, it's almost a double-edged sword, because it's so phenomenal. You can buy a place for 5% down, you get a better interest rate, but it definitely makes margins a lot thinner when you move out, you know, 366 days later. And I've had some interesting discussions with different investors, different finance people, and get your take on here. Because part of me says, you know, hey, what if the margins are low or zero or even negative cash flows, a couple bucks a month? You got the place for 5% down. You got a ton of reserves in the bank. You know, comparing that to saving up 20% down for a $300,000 property, that's what, 60 grand right there versus 5% down, which is more like 15 or 20 grand. You know, where do you get that difference of, hey, I'm buying a place that's working really well for me, I'm going to just buy it long term, you know, numbers work out. You hold on to anything for 20 or 30 years in Denver, you're going to be a happy person, is my personal belief. Did you run into those factors or ever kind of debate that scenario? Because, you know, margins are getting tighter and tighter every year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head. Is even if we're going to break even or maybe a little bit less cash flow, somebody's paying our mortgage for us. And like you said, 10, 20 years down the road, time and market rents are going to increase and we're going to be happy that we made the decision to buy.
And would you increase on those numbers or on like a property like that, would you have a higher reserve other than 6 months for more cushion? That's what I'm really curious about, is how your finance brain has wrapped around with that, you know, that added risk.
Yeah, that's something we'd be prepared to do if we couldn't find anything with the numbers to work, just to get in. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You need a little bit more cash reserves.
Okay. So would you do like 9 months, 12 months, or is it just hard to say? I know I'm kind of putting you on a spot here.
Yeah, kind of case by case. But yeah, I think you're pretty close. Yeah, probably 12 months is what I'd be thinking.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head in agreement. You guys can't see it, but that's kind of what my mind has come to as well. Cool. So had that place under contract. I forget, why did it fall out?
So we actually did the inspection and we kind of made a gentleman's agreement that we're not going to nitpick over small cosmetic stuff, but if there's anything health, safety related or anything major, you know, that would. So we did the inspection. There were, you know, probably 43 items, a lot of them small cosmetic. We didn't mind putting a little bit of cash into it. But there were three major concerns. One was the electrical panel. I think it was Standard Pacific or Federal Pacific.
Oh, yep.
But the inspector said, it's not a matter of, you know, if this thing's going to fail, it's when you definitely need to replace it. So that was like $3,000, which we were probably willing to eat. But then more concerning is the water was kind of running a yellowish tint. And we just thought maybe the initial walkthrough is because nobody had run the water in a while. And come to find out, all of it was done in 1950s galvanized steel, the entire piping. And the inspector kind of showed me certain areas where it was actually corroding. You could see the rust in the pipes. And he's like, to be honest, to be safe, this place, you need to repipe the thing. Mm. So that was like $7,000-$8,000 there. And then finally, the last straw was we did the pipe cam, the main line out to the sewer. And it was a big lot, probably 150-foot sewer line. And like every 4 feet, there were cracks. And he's like, man, this thing just needs to go. You're going to tear up the lawn, pull this thing out.
And you're looking like a full replacement for the line, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that in the water now, yeah.
And yeah, it was just, we decided that's just too much. So, you know, we asked if they wanted to help us. You know, well, first we asked if they would, you know, fix all the items. And they said, no, we have 26 other offers. You know, this is the way the market is. We'll move on to the next. And we said, so be it. So,
that was the right call. Like, that's the thing. It's tough, but that was the right call because it needed, you know, that's $15,000 worth of work.
Yep, exactly. So we started looking at different areas because Southwest Denver was highly competitive. We weren't finding a ton of stuff that we can get. So we would spend, every weekend we'd go to some open houses. We'd find, you know, Martha and I would look at different areas. So we started looking up north a little bit more, Arvada, Westminster, and she kind of decided that commute through I-25 really wasn't going to work. We didn't love any of the neighborhoods. You know, we got a lot of friends that live up there, but
because she works on the south side of Denver, right?
She lives like, she works downtown. So,
okay.
The I-25 commute was a little rough. So, checking out different neighborhoods, different open houses. We ended up looking at East Colfax and North Aurora area. And there's a certain stigma attached to the North Aurora, but we really liked the area. Because they got the University of Colorado Hospital kind of over on the east side of it. I don't know if you're familiar with the Stanley Marketplace.
No.
But they built a, it's kind of a cool marketplace as you start to see some of these popping up, like The Source and Rhino. And
yeah.
So somebody moved in. That's actually right on the border. You know, there's Stapleton to the northwest and then Lowry to the south. So it's kind of like in the middle of a lot of development going on. And there's certain, you know, I've lived through some transitioning neighborhoods. So I grew up in North Denver, which near Tennyson Street, which is the Highlands now, you know, as you know, one of the hottest areas in town.
And it was like that when you were growing up, right?
Yeah, not at all. So yeah, kind of, you know, I've been through it. So I start to see certain indicators. Also, the same duplex we bought in 2010 was in Clayton neighborhood, which in 2010 was a pretty sketchy part of town. I remember family members or friends are like, what are you doing living there? And then, yeah, now there's fix and flips every other house on the block. And so there's certain things that we look at. And I've noticed when you start to see like a brewery or a CrossFit gym, yoga studio, coffee shop, stuff like that, then you start to see the neighborhood changing a little bit. Then you'll see the houses begin, some investors come in, do some fix and flips, and ultimately scrape and build. So we saw a little bit of that.
I love that area. I mean, between all those hospitals out there by 225 and East Colfax, and whether you got the VA, you got CU, you got the Children's Hospital, like those places aren't going anywhere. And then you got Stapleton to the west. I mean, I think it's a great area. Like, a rising tide lifts all ships. That is a rising tide over there long term.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like you said, long term. We don't expect it to happen overnight. But yeah, 10, 15 years from now, I think it's going to be a good spot. And ultimately, there was a lot less competition on this. They were on the market for at least a couple of weeks without any offers. So we were able to find a place that worked for us in that neighborhood.
Cool. What were the, because I know you're moved in there now, rough numbers, you know, just of that property, like how is it acting as house hack number two and comparing to house hack number one?
So the original plan is we were going to, I'll walk you through the setup. So you go into the house, the main house is a two bedroom, one bath, just kind of your standard house and, you know, nice kitchen. Nice bathroom. We looked at similar houses for rent in the area, you know, $1,500, $1,600 a month. And then as you go out the back of that, there's a landing to a staircase. And the staircase goes upstairs and there's basically a studio apartment. There's a bathroom up there. There was a refrigerator, kind of little area. You could put a kitchen if you wanted. Looked like somebody had actually lived there. You know, we didn't think about renting that area out. But and then from that landing, there's another door that goes into a laundry room. And then in that laundry room, there's a separate entrance to the outside and then stairs to the basement. So it was just what we were looking for. It had a separate entrance where somebody can come in, kind of a shared laundry room area like we had. And then downstairs, the basement had two bedrooms, kitchen, bathroom, just basic mother-in-law apartment.
Yeah.
So the plan was to live in that mother-in-law apartment, rent the upstairs for $1,600 a month. And then there was actually a big garage. They had advertised it as a four-car garage, but it's really big with two bays. And there was somebody renting it for $350 a month. And he was really adamant during the inspection and everything. I actually met him and he really wanted to stay on. So
it was basically just a neighbor using it for storage, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. He's a retired guy and keeps all his stuff in there and toys around. So yeah, we figured $1,600 a month for the main house, $350 for the garage, and then our mortgage is about $1,900 with the 5% down.
Yeah.
So basically break even.
Yeah.
On that property.
Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, the current market, I mean, that is a really, really strong property for a house hack.
Yeah, so worked out well. And then we were actually showing the house to friends and family, and one of our friends is looking for a place to live, and she said, you know, she's living in an apartment now for $1,600 a month. They're just raising it to $1,800. It's too much for her. And she really wanted to live in the basement. We told her, well, we're going to live in the basement. You know, do you want to rent the upstairs for $1,600? She's like, no, I really want to be in this basement. So, you know, we kind of threw out $1,200, which is more than we thought that we can get for the basement when we moved out. But, you know, she really wanted to live there, pay $1,200. So, you know, no vacancy. We really didn't have to do any work to place a tenant. And we ended up living in the main level of the home and then renting the garage and the basement for $1,500. So, you know, rough numbers, you know, maybe minus $300 to live in the nice main house.
But like I said, you're living the nicer part, easy peasy tenant placement. And I'm assuming since you know the person, there's a lot that's probably nicer to know the tenant versus not. And then as far as your duplex, because you were still renting out the 2-1 side, but you moved out of the 3-1 side?
Correct.
Okay, then what were you getting in rent for the side you moved out?
So, yeah, surprisingly, looking at similar properties, they're, you know, really high. So I was initially thinking like $1,600, $1,700. So I figured, yeah, maybe you can push a little bit looking at some of the other places that were renting for $2,000 or $2,100. And there are full houses in the neighborhood now renting in the $2,000 range. So we asked for $1,800, put the listing on Craigslist. We use Cozy now for tenant placement. So I think they put a listing on Zillow, I believe. And then go Section 8. So we had good luck with Section 8 tenants. And I kind of have my own thoughts about why I prefer Section 8. I know it's scary and there's a certain stigma attached to Section 8 tenants as well. But they've worked out well for us. So went to gosection8.com, which is where they place Section 8 tenants.
Yeah, it's basically a place where you can go on there and place an ad saying, hey, we accept Section 8 vouchers. And that is as far as I talk to investors, that's probably the majority, or that's the website where majority of investors match up with their Section 8 tenants.
Yep. So when we placed ads on all three of the sources, I think we had like 100 total interested between emails, calls, texts.
Over how long?
So that was I think it took about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But yeah, most of
over 3 weeks, you had 100-ish people call, text, or email.
And about 80 of them came from the Go Section 8. There's a lot of demand for Section 8 housing right now. Not a lot of.
And what was what's the Section 8 rent for a 3-1?
Well, so I was a little worried because there's two, I would call them like big bedrooms, you know, windows and closets. And then the third bedroom's smaller. It doesn't have a closet and it's a little bit smaller. So I was a little concerned that they might not count that or consider that a third bedroom. And I think it was $1,599 for two and like $21 for a three in that area. So
that's a big difference.
We're kind of right in the middle. And yeah, I was worried, you know, just in case maybe they step it down to $1,599 and we'd be fine. But yeah, I later found out that we could have gotten like $2,099 for rent, but you know, we'll increase the rent.
You'll bump it up next. Yeah, we'll you got around the $1,800 you're asking for then?
Yep. So we do. Yeah. Tons of interest. You know, there's a funnel. So I have a 9-to-5 job and I can't answer the phone all the time, but I try to return all the calls, all the emails and do an initial phone screen.
Yeah, actually, let me pause you there. I'm going to go into more detail because we get this question a lot, like, because no matter how many checklists you have, your first time placing a tenant, like, you learn a ton, but you've placed a few, you're placing it again with experience now. What is your funnel? What's your process so you're not running around like crazy and having, you know, 20 no-shows to look at a property?
Yeah, so, yeah, we definitely learned this time, too. So, from the 100 people that were interested, let's say with phone calls and emails, texts. I actually got 80 on the phone for what I call like a phone screen. So I'll just kind of explain the property, let them know it's a side-by-side duplex. They're going to share the washer and dryer. You know, they're responsible for Excel, just kind of the ins and outs of the property, make sure they're still interested. And then I'll ask, you know, what's their income? Have they worked with Section 8 before, if that applied? And then just those basic questions about the credit, you know, any evictions, bankruptcies, judgments, current derog, you know, what's going on. Let them know that we don't take evictions. So you don't want to waste your time or my time. And then of those from the phone screen, I would say, the first weekend I scheduled, 10 people to come look at the property and I scheduled it in 30-minute increments. So we took a Saturday and went over there, you know, from like 9 to 2 p.m., something like that.
Oh, so you scheduled them each in their own half-hour slot windows.
Yes. Okay. That's how I started. And yeah, of the 10 people, 3 showed up. And I'm like, oh man. So of those 3, one person was really interested actually on the phone.
Sounds about right as far as numbers.
Yeah. And then, yeah. So of course, the one interested, he was trying to give me a deposit over the phone and just way too eager. You know, I knew something was going on. So only one person applied. And of course, there is an eviction 3 months ago, even though I told him we didn't take evictions. So I still had this huge bank of people. People are still calling and texting on it. So the next weekend, we kind of thought about like an open house idea. So yeah, we're going to be there 10 to 12. Hey, you want to come look at it? We'll be there from 10 to 12. And we had like 22 people say they were going to show up. And I think we had 8 people show up. And we got 2 applications from that. And we still had some other people that are interested. So on the next Saturday, so this is the third weekend, I scheduled 15-minute increments. So, and I scheduled 2 people for each time slot. And then I had them text or call to confirm that they were going to show up.
Why did you go from the open house model weekend number 2 to going back towards time slots for weekend number 3?
Well, we had like some nosy neighbors and just people that weren't really interested, just kind of, you know, we're guilty of this too, going to open houses. We're not really interested, you know, just checking it out.
Of course.
And yeah, we just, out of the 22 we thought we were going to show up, we didn't have very many. So, yeah, I figured let's confirm. So I scheduled two for every time slot in the 15-minute increments. And we had a much better show rate and they had confirmed and they were going to be there. And it kind of created this sense of demand for the place because there's people coming in. I'm, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a madhouse getting
everybody.
You're
like, oh, hold on, I got to go talk to this person.
Yeah,
now, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, you get over.
Which is actually the perfect environment because it shows that demand and scarcity. Like that is, we do the same thing with open houses. Like it's great.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. You know, going forward, that's how I'll do it from now on. So yeah, then we ended up getting another applicant there. And
so they do, and the applicant, they were doing that through Cozy, right?
Yep. So that's exactly, yeah. So
tell us about Cozy, because I've looked at that website once, but that was many months ago. So tell me and our listeners what that is and what it does.
So you set up a profile, you put an ad on there, list your property, and, you know, similar like a Craigslist ad, you put all the stuff in there. And then when a tenant's interested in it, you send them the link to that advertisement and they click on it. They put in all their personal information. You know, they pay the $35, I believe it is, for the application, you know, put their credit card number in there. And then you'll get an email like you have a new applicant and then you can click on it and they filled out, you know, all their personal information, references, their job, their income. And then it runs a background check and then a credit check.
Okay.
And, you know, I look at tens of thousands of credit reports every year. So it's a little, you know, it's a little different. It looks similar to the Credit Karma credit card report where you.
But it's good enough to be able to make a decision. Like that's the.
Exactly.
Okay. Yep. That's the important thing. It's good enough.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah, it shows like all their accounts and their payment history.
Yeah. So, how do you like using Cozy? Because you're the third or fourth person I've talked to that said they're using it. I've done nothing more than look at the website for 10 seconds.
Yeah, it's been great because I think the first time I did, you know, back in 2010, I was kind of doing paper applications. I got people's social security numbers and I'm going to the website and entering all this information and pulling credit. This just takes all of that work out of it. I just get an email, I click on it, I can see all their information right there.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Great. So then you got three or four applicants, you said?
Yep. So yeah, I think there was a total of four.
Okay.
Overall. And then we went with one who, yeah, worked out really well for us, Section 8. And she's been with Section 8 before. I think similar situation where the landlord, a lot of people are selling their house at the Section 8 because the prices have increased so much. So landlord was selling her house. She needed a place to live. Yeah, part of the phone screen too, I'll ask, why are you moving? And, you know, what's your long-term plans? How long do you plan on staying? Because we found that long-term renters just work out a lot better for this business model.
Oh, yeah. A lot less turnover, a lot less headache then.
Exactly.
Great. So you're in house hack number two, and I'm kind of shifting gears a little bit because you're one of the investors that have contributed a chapter to the book. And as we're recording this, it's going to be published soon. When the podcast is published, it may already be published, the book. But like the Denver Real Estate Investing Strategies, where you wrote a chapter on there talking about your investing plan. So going forward now with the experience you have, and I know you want to do a couple more house hacks, just kind of talk about what your investing plans are moving forward, your goals are, and kind of what that looks like.
Yeah, the house hack's been great, but I think there's a shelf life on it. We're planning on having kids the next couple of years, and we'll probably be through with the house hacking. So in the next 2-3 years, we want to pick up another two properties and then start looking at different.
And then we'll just settle down by the primary residence, raise a family.
Exactly.
And go back to more traditional than buying some
20-25% down.
Yeah.
Then, you know, hopefully we'll be in a position where we have the cash down to do that and reserves, and I think we'll be in a good spot.
And do you have any goals as far as like how many properties you want to acquire total, or kind of what's your finance guy? Now you got goals, like are you looking for a number of properties, a certain number of gross rents? Kind of what's the end target?
Yeah. Oh, it's always changing, a moving target. When I first got into it, the financial independence was just enough, passive, or I guess I should say semi-passive income with real estate to cover all of our living expenses. And we live pretty frugal. You know, you don't have a ton of living expenses. So we're really close to that right now, just off one property. So now, you know, as life changes, I want a little bit more to be able to save and invest for the future. And I just like real estate and being involved in it. So the goal now is to replace the income that we're earning from our W-2 jobs with. So getting the four house hack properties, you know, we got two now. Two more will get us on the right path to that.
Yeah, great. So as we wrap up, I know one of your other goals is to do more networking with investors and other people in the real estate industry around town. So you know, kind of share with everyone ways they can contact you, who you want to network with, just, you know, good people to start meeting around town.
Yeah, absolutely. I just love real estate. I guess I consider myself a real estate junkie. Love meeting people and talking to others about what they're doing and how they're making money, what they think of the market. Just shoot me an email at zack.vanproyan@gmail.com.
And I will put the email address in the show notes as well, or you guys can email me and I'll definitely do a quick email introduction. Cool, Zack. So, you know, actually I got two more questions for you. First one is, what tips do you have for people that want to get into house hacking? Because house hacking is becoming an incredibly popular way to get into real estate investing. Because, you know, the numbers are just, they're just insane what you can do with that amount of leverage you can get. So what advice can you give to people who want to start doing what you're doing by house hacking?
I think first thing is you want to create a balance. So I think it's important to know what you're comfortable living with, whether that's living in a four-bedroom house, you live in one bedroom and rent the others out, or Airbnb, if you're comfortable sharing a bathroom or a kitchen, or, you know, in my case, it was more, I was comfortable with the duplex idea or the separate living. So I would just say, find that balance of what you're comfortable with. And then the other thing is stay away from trying to time the market. You know, there's tons of experts out there on both sides. And the truth is we just don't know. But I think if you have enough in cash reserves, just conservative underwriting, and you'll have tenants paying for the property with a little bit of cushion, you know, just when you're comfortable, just buy a place.
That is great advice. All right. Last question for you. So if you go back in time now, I guess 9-10 years, and talk to your, you know, younger, inexperienced self as you're getting into buying your first house hack, what piece of advice would you give yourself 10 years ago?
Stick to the plan, not worry about bubbles or timing. Just when you're comfortable, you're in a position, you got a house where the numbers work, you know, just do it.
Great. All right, Zack, thank you so much for coming on here. I enjoyed it. I know our listeners will as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I enjoyed it.